Hi, this is Russ Taft.
Hi, this is John Olifanti.
Hi, this is John Schlippen-Petra.
Hi, this is Kim Boyce.
Hey, everybody, Stephen Curtis Chapman here, and you are listening to Jesus Freaks Final to Digital.
Hi, I'm Jason Huddle, host of Jesus Freaks Final to Digital. Before we get into this week's program, I just wanted to take a moment to thank you for downloading this episode and giving us a listen. If you really like what you hear, we'd love to have your support. How can you do that, you say? Well, I'm glad you asked. Simply visit patreon.com/JesusFreaksPodcast and become a monthly sponsor. Now, you can do that for as little as two measly dollars per month, or you can go higher and get special perks, like advance access to episodes when available, the opportunity to submit questions I will ask our artists on future episodes, and even your very own Jesus Freaks t-shirt. Again, that's patreon.com/JesusFreaksPodcast. Patreon is spelled P-A-T-R-E-O-N. And hey, if you'd like your business or organization to become a sponsor of this program, let us know by visiting our website, JesusFreaksPodcast.com, and click on the Become a Sponsor link at the bottom of the page. Now that we've gotten that out of the way, let's get on with the show.
Hi, this is Jennifer York from Rachel Rachel, and you're listening to Jesus Freaks Vinyl to Digital.
As one half of the power duo known as DeGarmo and Key, Eddie DeGarmo helped set the standard for contemporary Christian music in the 80s and 90s. Today, as our guest, he'll talk about his life, his lifelong friend Dana Key, and how they came to know Christ together.
And so when I gave my life to Christ, that was on a Sunday. I went back to high school the very next day and saw Dana walking down the hallway and said to him, "I found Jesus." And he said, "I didn't know he was missing."
We'll also take a look back at their music, the stories behind the songs, Eddie's brand new book, and of course, the day he found out Dana had passed away.
Yeah, it was a strange, surreal time because he was young. He was 56.
Mm-hmm.
And died from a condition that, you know, a lot of people suffer from. It was what they call a pulmonary embolism. And he died suddenly. I found out the next morning, actually from my daughter. Yeah, that was a sad day.
Is that something you had to wrestle with God a little bit? That's coming up right now on Jesus Freaks Final to Digital, a presentation of Cabco Media Group and a recommended podcast of Way FM. To the program now, Eddie DeGarmo, one half of the power duo of the 1980s and 90s, DeGarmo and Key. Eddie, thank you so much, first of all, for being on the program today.
Hey, it's my pleasure and it's my honor, and I hope you're doing well.
I am. And I'm honored to have you on this program. I am a longtime fan of D&K, longtime listener, and I too played the guitar. So, you know, we have that going for us.
Can't be all bad.
Hey, so why don't you, first of all, just tell us a little bit about your journey with Christ, how when you came to know Christ, and then how you came to be DeGarmo and Key.
Oh my gosh. Well, if you go back, you know, long time, I grew up with my mother and dad, and my mother was the piano player in church. And so she started me playing piano at a very early age. I was probably three, you know, maybe four. And like most 3 or 4 year olds, I didn't like it very much. In fact, I kind of hated it. And, you know, the other kids would be outside playing and she'd have me practicing stupid piano. and then when I got in the first and second grade, she sent me off to a piano teacher because I guess I was too much to handle by that time. And the teacher was this pretty smart lady because something she did that I think was very instrumental in getting me into playing was she went out and bought me a Beatles songbook, which the Beatles were the flavor of the day. then. This was the, you know, early 60s. And so I could play the songs that I heard on the radio. And that really got me going. So I started playing music and started really getting into it and learning songs off of records. And, you know, in those days, we still had vinyl records. And, we still have them today, I guess. But, you know, that's all we had
then. It's all we had, right.
Yeah, and you would pick up the needle and, you know, and set it back down and learn the riff and learn the song. And so I started learning songs that way. And when I was 9, maybe early 10 years old, something like that, my dad, this is a pretty funny part of the story, because people say, how do you get started in Christian music? Well, I guess it kind of got started at the West Memphis Dog Track, because he went over there one night and won $1,200. Which was a fortune in 1964, and went out the next day and bought me a Farfisa combo compact organ and a little amplifier. And so I was off to the races, you know.
Started with gambling. That's a great
story. Started with gambling. Isn't that pretty weird? But that's how I started playing in rock bands as early as the fifth grade. And wow. When I was in the seventh grade, I met Dana Key. Well, I had met it before that, but we formed a band together and started playing little sock hops and little, you know, skating rink parties and this and that, and actually entered into a talent contest or two, and lost those famously, I should say. But music started getting serious for the both of us about the time high school hit. And we got involved in a pretty popular band around the Memphis area called Globe in those days. And so, you know, we were playing everywhere you could think of, you know, 3 or 4 nights a week. And ended up signing a record contract when we were 15 years old and thought I was on my way. I mean, I always wanted to be in a rock band and always wanted to do those kind of things, but I never dreamed it would happen quite the way it happened, but it did for us then. And it was during the height of the Vietnam War, and I had 2 older brothers that were in the military, and one of them was in Vietnam and one of them was in Germany. And when I was a senior in high school, I was about to graduate, my brother from Germany came home, a very different person than what he went, and he was just a wild dog, man. He went out and bought a big motorcycle and started riding with a motorcycle gang. And, you know, we were just a normal kind of middle-class family. And so that was not anything that was kosher in our family, really. And, you know, one night I came home late from playing a dance. It's probably 2 o'clock in the morning. And I came inside and my older brother was sitting at our dining room table in the dark. And he had a bottle of whiskey on the table, and he had a Bible on the table. And he would stare at the Bible for a minute, and then he would stare at the bottle for a minute. And I guess that bottle represented a lot of evil things for him at that moment in his life. And so I turned the lights on and said, "What are you doing, man? You know, it's like, what are you doing down here sitting in the dark?" He goes, "I got to tell you this story, Eddie. I got to tell you this story. When I was in Germany," he said, "I made a decision to give my life to Jesus." And he said, "When I got home, I was really just afraid to tell my friends about it. And I was afraid to tell you about it. You know, afraid you guys would, you know, kind of all shun me," which we probably would have, frankly. But he said, "Through all of this that I've been going through with this craziness and this motorcycle gang," he said, "God just won't let me go." And he said, "So," he said, "that commitment I made in Germany to Jesus is still good today." And he said, "God won't let me go." So that really spoke to me. I used to stay out late. I had a body disease. I couldn't wreck my car. I couldn't find the keys. I heard the voice of God tell me to leave it alone. You gotta train the cat. Danger zone. I used to shake my fist. I wasn't angry, boy. I wanted to fight the world. I didn't know what for. I heard the voice of God tell me to leave it alone. last few months, my brother began to tell me about how Christ was different for him than it was for us growing up, kind of as little kids in the church, you know, and how Jesus was real to him. And it wasn't just something that happened on a Sunday morning service. And so over the course of the next few months, you know, God began to convict me and, you know, speak to my heart in ways that I didn't expect. And I gave my life to Jesus one Sunday in March of 1972. And from then on, it's all been different, and not all been easy, by the way, but all been very different. So that's how that happened.
So let me back up a little bit and ask you, what was Dana Key like in those formative years as a kid when you guys were playing these sock ops? And
well, I mean, you know, we were, both of us were just, you know, crazy kids in the 60s getting into all kinds of trouble. Most all kids got into in the 60s. It was the hippie generation, and we were trying to be every part of it that we knew how, you know. And Dana and I were friends, but at the same time, we were, you know, we would kind of push each other to see who could be the cooler guy, you know. And so when I gave my life to Christ, that was on a Sunday. I went back to high school the very next day and saw Dana walking down the hallway and said to him, "Dana, I got to talk to you. I said, "I found Jesus." And he said, "I didn't know he was missing." That's what he said. Which was typical Dana smart aleck stuff. But I said, "I'm serious, man. You know, I'm being serious with you." So we actually skipped school, which was kind of weird because I had been a Christian for one day. I wasn't sure that that wasn't permissible activity, you know. So we skipped school and ended up hiding out in a janitor's closet in high school. And I had a Bible that I'd picked up from our course class. And I just started reading the Bible to him. And I, for all I know, I was reading out of Leviticus. I have no idea. But, you know, before long, he said, "You know, I want what you have. I want what I can see. It's real to you. And I want to know Jesus in the way that you have met him." And so we prayed together in that janitor's closet. And that's how the two of us came to Christ.
Incredible. So when did you guys begin your Christian music career? How did that come about? Obviously, you were already playing together. But when did it become a thing where you realized that you were going to be able to make a career out of this?
Well, that, I mean, the career part of it came a few years later, actually. But how we got into playing Christian music was pretty organic, in that we went back to our band practice that same very night that Dana became a Christian that morning. And I tried the same tact with our band that I did with Dana and said, "You know, guys, I got to tell you about what happened to me. I found Jesus." And they were like, "Oh, man, that's cool. That's great. That's cool. Can we talk about something else now?" And it was kind of that, you know. And so over the course of the next two or three months, it's probably about 3 months, it just became apparent that we were oil and water with the band, if you will. Dan and I, they were going one direction and two of us were pulling another direction. So we decided to quit our band, which was a very difficult decision because we were, you know, high school kids in a record contract, which is kind of like your, you know, goal in life. And then all of a sudden you just give it up. That was a hard day. I still remember it. But Christian music, we didn't know it was Christian music. And I know that sounds peculiar in today's, you know, conversations and talking about, because Christian music has grown to be such a huge genre around the world.
Yeah.
But in those days, we didn't know what it was. We just started writing songs really that just reflected our faith. And, you know, we would write about things that were important to us and challenges that we had as young people that had given their life to Jesus in a world that obviously didn't care a lot for Jesus, still doesn't, by the way. And so that's how we started in Christian music. And we had this recording studio that we would rehearse in. And this fella that owned the studio was our manager when we were in our rock band. And he kind of liked Dana and I. And so he said, you know, he said, once you guys can continue to practice here, that's fine with me, and you rehearse here. It was a converted furniture store, kind of a big room. I mean, not a huge room, but a pretty sizable room. And so over the course of the next few months, the kids around Memphis, young people around Memphis, found out that there was a Jesus rock band that was playing at this old studio in the ghetto, because it was in the middle of the tough part of town. And they would come down by the dozens and sometimes by the hundreds to our, you know, band rehearsals to just hear us play. And we probably didn't know more than 4 or 5 songs. It was pretty funny. And we didn't have a bass player. I played bass with my feet in those days on the Hammond B3.
Yeah.
But later, I guess it became more apparent to us. Well, it did become more apparent to us that other people around the country were doing the same thing. You know, you had Res Band in Chicago. You know, you had the West Coast movement with Randy Stonehill and Larry Norman and those guys, and Love Song and Phil Keaggy from up in New Jersey in those days, actually Philadelphia. But we didn't know about any of them, and they probably didn't know about us either. And so I still remember when Dana came home with a Larry Norman album. It was Only Visiting This Planet. It was in probably summer of 1972, and it just blew my mind to hear that somebody else was doing music like what we heard in our heads, you know. So it was pretty cool day.
That is cool. I want to jump forward a little bit, talk about some of the songs that you guys did. There were so many great songs over the years, you know, Charge of the Light Brigade, 666. You name it. I'm going to get to Brother Against Brother in just a second. But there was a song called Rock Solid that you guys did. And my understanding is that was a situation that was written from real life, that you guys had been approached by basically record companies wanting to sign you, but they wanted you to dilute your message. Is that pretty accurate?
Yeah. That happened to us more than once in our career, that the mainstream would come knocking on our door. Cause you know, we really worked hard at being a good band and trying to write good songs. And we were, you know, elated that other people recognized that and enjoyed our music. But the mainstream industry is, I mean, it's a business. That's what they do. And so they came knocking on our doors more than once. And that song, Rock Solid, was written really as a response to one of those latest things where there was a global major rock band that was going to take us on tour, and we were going to record for their imprint label with one of the majors, and their manager came to a show. And, you know, at the end of our show, it was our tradition that we would give our audience a chance to respond to Jesus. And we saw, you know, over the years, literally hundreds of thousands of people come to Christ in our concerts. So we did that evening as well. And this rock and roll manager, you know, I could see him, you know, really uncomfortable and while this was going on. And he came to see us the next day and he said, you know, guys, he said, this is just not going to work for us. He said, I can't have you on stage talking about Jesus in front of so-and-so's audience. And he was actually very kind about it. He wasn't weird about it. And frankly, as I reflected on that in my life, I think that he probably was right, you know. But still, it was another time that we had been told by the mainstream that we couldn't continue with our straightforward approach about who Jesus is in our music if we expected success.
you had success for many years in the Christian mainstream music, not necessarily secular mainstream, but I mean, I would venture to guess that's where God wanted you, correct?
Oh, yeah, I think that's right. And I know that's right because that's where we were. And again, that wasn't the only time the mainstream came knocking. It was, there were three or four or five occasions that similar kinds of things happened. You know, we had one record in the late 80s that was on Capitol Records, one of the big mainstream companies. And we had a song called Every Moment that their radio promotion team had taken to mainstream radio and was number one on more than a few stations, quite a few around the country. And we did a concert in L.A. and Capitol Records' whole promotion team came to the concert. And I kind of knew what was going to happen because we had been through this a couple times before. And so I actually went to Dana before the show and I said, you know, Dana, we do our normal show tonight and give an invitation. I said, these people probably are going to drop us. And I just want you to realize that's what's going to happen probably. And, you know, I'm all for it as I know you are, but that's going to be the consequence of us doing that. And he said, yeah, but man, I can't change who we are knowing that. And so we did. We gave an altar call that night. And the very next day, frankly, they dropped us like a hot potato. Mm-hmm. I mean, our video was in heavy rotation on MTV. And as I said, we were number one in several markets in America with Every Moment. And they dropped us just like we didn't exist, you know.
But think about those souls that were saved that night.
Well, yeah, man. I mean, you know, there's always a good end to that story when you deny yourself to follow Jesus. It doesn't mean that you don't suffer through it sometimes because it can be painful, you know. And from the time I was a little boy, I always wanted to be a rock star. And so I definitely had to put that one on the altar more than once.
Do you have a favorite D&K album?
Oh, no. No, I don't. There's something about most of our records that I really, really like. You know, the earlier records were definitely a little more raw than some of the later ones. And through the center of our career, during the Mission of Mercy and Communication days and Charge of the Light Brigade days, we had made a turn somewhat in some of our songs, not all of them, because we needed to gain broad acceptance at Christian radio, we felt like, to sustain what we were called to do. And some of the critics have rightly said, frankly, that we compromised. Compromise is a funny word. It's, you know, when you use the word compromise associated with your faith, it's always a very negative word. If you use the word compromise in the political spectrum, it's usually a very positive word, right?
Right.
So it's a funny oxymoron sometimes, but we definitely did write some songs that we felt like would get broader appeal at the Christian radio format. And it worked for us big time from a career perspective.
What were some of those songs?
Oh, Let the Whole World Sing, Ready or Not, Destined to Win, you know.
Not your deepest songs, but definitely some of your more popular ones.
Yeah, some of the bigger ones, you know, frankly. And and I like those songs. It's not that I don't, but they were written from a perspective of wanting to achieve very broad appeal, if you will.
I got you. I want to get into Brother Against Brother because, quite frankly, over the last year specifically, I've listened to that song a lot.
Oh, wow.
Because it is so relevant to today, which is super cool, I think, because it was written, what, 30 years ago-ish. That song, frankly, that whole album, D&K, was so good. But Brother Against Brother, it seemed to me that one meant something special to you guys. Am I right on that, or is that just in my mind?
you know, that's, I wrote that song in particular to, I guess, a plea, for lack of a better word, to a particular television preacher that was very popular in those days that just had a real issue with our kind of music and with us in particular, and called us out by name several times on the air. And this pastor had audience of millions around the world. And so I wrote that song as a response, you know, asking him to, you know, why is it that we fight each other?
Right.
You know, we have a common enemy here.
Right.
Yeah. I think it's probably spoken to you as much as anything in these crazy times in the world of our political spectrum.
Yeah, that's what's so great about that song, is because it applies in so many different areas. Yes, absolutely. We tear each other down as members of the church. In fact, Glenn Kaiser, who was on this show last season, he talked about that very thing, that we don't tend to show the love of Christ to other Christians, much less the world. But then you can apply that song to politics. You can apply it to just social media. And, you know, it's just incredible, that song's versatility to me. And so I keep listening to it over and over again to remind myself.
And, well, I appreciate it. But that's why it was written. I mean, it's all about, you know, Christians can be really good at shooting each other in the back. And we don't need to do that. There's enough for us to be in steadfast walk together against what's going on in the world, that we certainly don't need to wound each other in the process.
As most of our listeners probably know, we lost Dana Key way too soon. How was his passing for you? How did you cope with that?
Well, I mean, Dana and I had been friends all the way through elementary school and high school and into our career. And we probably treated each other more like physical brothers in some respects. I mean, we did fight like cats and dogs sometimes. But that's what brothers do, right? And we loved each other and always looked out for the best for each other, I think. And so when we lost him, it was only a week after we had played a concert, which was rare in those days for us to do that. You know, we would play really about once every 12 to 18 months somewhere that somebody would ask us to. And I was actually driving back to Nashville that night. We had played in a resort town called Gatlinburg, Tennessee, at a at a motorcycle rally. Pretty funny. And had a good time. And Dana called me on my cell phone when I was driving back to town. It was probably 1 o'clock in the morning. And he said, man, I just love being with you tonight. And he said, can't we do some more of this? I sure would like to do some more. And I said, well, yeah, let's look at that. And then he said, you know, I know we've been up a few times in the past to be into the Gospel Music Hall of Fame. But he said, it'd be really cool if we could do it this year because Johnny Cash is up and he's also from Memphis. So sure enough, that, you know, he passed away a week later and we got inducted in the Hall of Fame about a month after that. So, yeah, it was a strange, surreal time because he was young. He was 56 and died from a condition that, you know, a lot of people suffer from. It was a what they call a pulmonary embolism, where you have a blood clot that passes into your lung from your leg, basically, suddenly. And he died suddenly. And I found out the next morning, actually from my daughter, that saw it on one of the social media sites, because I didn't see it before she did. So, yeah, that was a sad day.
Is that something you had to wrestle with God a little bit?
Yeah, probably. I'd say so. I mean, death is a weird concept. Thus, why a lot of us follow Jesus, because when we follow Jesus, we don't suffer through eternal death the same way, right?
Right.
We lose our bodies, but we know that there's something better. And I did suffer with it, and I understand that people die. I understand we all get older, but, you know, it's always harder when someone dies younger than it is, sure. Whether it's a tragedy or a health condition or whatever. It's always more difficult. And by Dana and I being so close, it even made it more difficult. And, you know, it wasn't but about a year and a half later that his wife, which was about the same age as he was when he died, passed away.
Oh, my goodness. I didn't know that.
So, yeah. And, you know, I was honored by doing the eulogy at both the services. But by the same token, you know, it was a hard period of time emotionally, wondering why that some of us survive those things and some of us don't. And it, I mean, even in today's world, with all the tragedy that we're seeing based around the COVID and all that, I mean, I find that most of the hysteria is about people that are just, they're just scared out of their wits to die. I mean, they just don't have any kind of eternal perspective. And it's not like that I'm not apprehensive about it. I mean, I think I'm man enough to face up to it, but probably when it happens, I'll be a wimp, you know. But I do think so much hysteria is pressed by that fact that people are just, oh my gosh, they're just frightened beyond comprehension. And I think that must lead to that they don't have any kind of eternal perspective through a relationship with Christ and what that means in a different kind of way. So
you recently released a book. Tell us a little bit about that, and what's it about, and where can we get it?
Well, I mean, you can get it at Amazon or you can get it at most bookstores. It's called Rebel for God. And it's more or less my story. And, you know, when I first started writing that, I was writing it for my family, but didn't think about it being published for public consumption, if you will. But as my wife and others began to read some of it, they were like, Eddie, some of these stories are just too fantastic not to share with others. And so, you know, decided to have it published. And, you know, just go to Amazon.com. It's there, Rebel for God. And I think you'll enjoy it. And I've had a really interesting journey in that I'm one of those kind of weird people that was born with a left brain and a right brain. So, yeah, I don't know if that's bad or good, but, you know, I always enjoyed the creative process, but at the same time, I was always the guy trying to figure out how to buy another tank of gas to get to the next town, you know. So when Dana and I retired from full-time, you know, doing concerts in 1993, really, I went on the business side of Christian music and arguably had more success there than I did even with the band D&K, you know, working with artists like DC Talk and Toby Mac and Rebecca St. James and Audio Adrenaline and Chris Tomlin and Matt Redman and Stephen Curtis Chapman and Switchfoot and, oh my gosh, you know.
You mean that's it? That's the best you can come up with?
You know, NF, I mean, you know, I mean, I signed him to his first, you know, publishing deal over those guys, Delirious. And so I had the pleasure of working with some very, very talented people for many, many years. And so I feel like that God used me, if you will, as the coach, maybe even a greater way than he used me as the player. So. Mm.
Yeah, but you couldn't have been a coach if you hadn't played. So
probably not. And I mean, I at least knew some of the artist's psyche and how they felt and how they viewed the world and that sort of thing. And so I think that probably helped me. You know, I remember signing a little band called Skillet. And I first met John Cooper when he was 14. And he went to our church in Memphis. And I met him under difficult circumstances where I played a song in our Sunday morning service at our church, and his grandfather approached me after the song and he said, would you go see my grandson? He lost his mother to cancer a few weeks back and he's having a really, really hard time with it. And so I said, well, sure. And I didn't know John Cooper at the time. And, so I set up a time to see him, and of course I, you know, dressed in my motorcycle jacket, and got on my Harley Davidson, and rode over there all cool, like I was gonna win him over from the world of cool. And he answered the door, and I said, "Are you John?" He said, "Yeah." And I said, "Well, your grandfather, you know, wanted me to come say hello." And he said, "Eddie," he said, "before you come in this house," he said, "I want you to tell me why God didn't heal my mother." Mm-hmm. And I said, "Well, I don't know who said that. Who told you God didn't heal your mother?" And he said, "Well, she died." And I said, "Well, that doesn't mean she wasn't healed. That just means you didn't get to see it yet." And he looked at me puzzled and he goes, "Really?" And I said, "Well, yeah." I said, "You know, when we belong to Jesus, he either heals us in this world or the next, but we all get healed." Mm-hmm. And I said, sometimes we think of healing as all about, you know, being trapped in this physical body. But from God's perspective, it's about our eternal soul. And anyway, so we made good friends. So that was the beginning of our relationship. Pretty cool.
Very cool. And I can tell you, as somebody that lost his father way too early, that is a question that I wrestled with myself. So I appreciate you telling that story.
Well, it's hard, man. Death is tough. I mean, that's why Jesus talks about it so much. And, you know, the wonderful thing about knowing Jesus is we don't have to fear that anymore. We don't have to fear it. And for those that know him, I mean, there is no fear and there is no separation. And frankly, there is no death. We just pass from one life to another.
Right. So,
pretty cool.
So I'm running short on time and I don't want to take up too much more of yours, but I have to ask, do you have a favorite Dana Key story?
Oh man, I got to think through that. In all the years that I've done these interviews, I don't know that anybody has ever asked me that particular question.
See, that's what I try to do. I try to ask the questions that nobody else asks.
Well, I've got a few that I don't think I should share. Right. So
give us something appropriate.
One of the last concerts that Dana and I played before the band split up was in early 1994 at World Youth Day in Denver, Colorado. And we actually opened the day for Pope John Paul.
Oh, wow.
Which was a big deal. First of all, we didn't come from a Catholic background, so I think we were probably one of the very first Protestant artists ever asked to participate in that kind of event.
Yeah, that's incredible.
And I still remember we were doing sound check, and we were outside downtown Denver on some huge mall that would accommodate, who knows, a couple hundred thousand people probably. And there were these huge TV screens, jumbotrons all over. And Dana was out there warming his guitar up and he was kind of playing, you know, like Hendrix stuff and Star Spangled Banner and doing all that. And someone operating the video cameras put it on the shot of the Pope's plane landing at Mile High or Stapleton Airport, I guess it is in Denver. And you know, that particular Pope, his practice was as he would come down the steps of the plane and he would kneel and he would kiss the earth, right?
I remember that, yeah.
So he was doing that and Dana was playing the Star Spangled Banner. And this nun, this older lady that was a nun, she was really, really upset. And she came out on the stage and had a rolled up magazine and she started beating Dana with it on his back, telling him to quit. And he was like bending over. He's like, stop, stop. She's like, you can't do that. You know, the Holy Father, God didn't mean to. I didn't mean to. So that was one of my funnier days.
Oh, that's a great story, man. Thank you for sharing that one. That is hilarious. Well, thank you so much for spending some time with us today, man. I really enjoyed our conversation. And just thank you so much for that, all that you've done for Christian music through DeGarmo and Key and then as a producer. And just thank you so much. It's been a treat to follow your career and see what the impact that you've had for Christ.
Well, I'm honored to be part of your program and I wish you the best.
All right, man.
Sorry, it was a few minutes late. So
it's all good. Thanks so much, man. You take care.
Take care. Bye.
Once again, I'd like to thank our very special guest, Eddie DeGarmo, for being on the program today. Hey, if you like this program, please make sure you join our Facebook group page. It's Jesus Freaks Vinyl to Digital podcast page. Check us out there. Also, if you would like to contribute to this program, please feel free to visit patreon.com. That's patreon.com/Jesus Freaks Podcast. And we'd love to have your support. Hey, and you might even get some Jesus Freak goodies just for supporting us. Next week, make sure you tune in. The always funny and entertaining Brian Duncan will regale us with tales of his career, and we're always looking forward to talking to him. Once again, you have been listening to Jesus Freaks Vinyl to Digital, a presentation of Cabco Media Group, and a recommended podcast of Way FM. It is produced and hosted by myself, Jason Huddle, with special thanks to research assistant Kevin Jewell. I leave you now with a very special song. It has been a mantra of mine ever since I became a Christian. There is definitely nothing casual about the Christianity of DeGarmo and Key. Here is Casual Christian. Until next week, God bless. It's more than just a passing whim.
I've said this all before, a thousand times or more. I don't want to waste my life in chains of sin.